Here on Radio 4 FM, it's time for our Book of the Week. Tracy Thorn continues with her memoir, Bedsit Disco Queen. Tracy created the band Everything But The Girl with her husband Ben Watt while they were still at university. But even before they met, Tracy and Ben were already part of the indie music scene of the early 1980s, successfully releasing records with their own teenage bands.
Question. Is it a good idea to start a band with your boyfriend or girlfriend? Possibly not, but that's what I was about to commit to doing. Ben had released his solo album, North Marine Drive, by now, and I was planning to record a follow-up to A Distant Shore, and we were each still holding fast to an element of independence from the other. I was struggling to write songs fast enough, and at the same time, Ben was working on his own songs, and it got to the point where we had about four each, and it suddenly occurred to us that if we pooled the songs we had, there'd be nearly an album's worth. Our commitment to the idea of Everything But The Girl as a full-time band was about as profound as that. For God's sake, if we'd known we were going to carry on for years, we would have come up with a better name. Though our album, Eden, was finished in the autumn of 1983, it wouldn't be released until June 1984, nearly a whole year later, an unthinkable time gap in the world I'd been used to, where songs had been recorded in the morning and practically in the shops by tea time. And there was still another year to do at Hull University. For a while, I concentrated much more on studying and less on music, building up towards my finals in June 1984. Finally, in May 1984, just before my exams started, the first single from our album, Each and Every One, was released on the label Blanco y Negro. On the 4th of June 1984, at 9:30 in the morning, we sat the last exam of our finals, 17th Century Literature. Each and Every One was number 28 in the charts. We finished the exam, got straight on a train down to London, and were in the recording studio by the afternoon, finishing off a new B-side. Bye bye student life. Hello. Well, what exactly? I had no idea. In 1984, I'd never been on tour before. Neither had Ben. I'd done gigs with the Marine Girls here and there, one at a time, and Ben and I had done a couple of what would now be called acoustic shows, just the two of us. But touring seemed to be something that other bands did, proper bands, bands with careers. But now, here we were, with a booking agent and a tour manager and a set of printed and bound itineraries telling us where we were going to be every moment of every day for the next 4 weeks. A whole team of people had been hired, roadies, monitor engineers, lighting riggers, who were temporarily part of our entire existence, but who otherwise had nothing to do with us at all. We'd never met them before, and would possibly never see them again after the tour was over. In order to play live, we'd assembled a band. Phil Moxham from Young Marble Giants on bass, June Miles Kingston from the Modettes and Funboy 3 on drums, and Neil Scott on guitar, who'd auditioned after an ad was placed in the NME. The tour was something of a revelation, and I had to learn pretty quickly about the routine of travelling and sound checks and support acts and on-stage times and all the paraphernalia of life on the road. I was like a kid just let out of school. At the first hotel, I ran out into the corridor shouting, "June, I've got a phone in my room!" I'd barely travelled anywhere before and certainly had no experience of hotels. It all seemed very glamorous, though at that point the hotels were anything but. Arriving late at one overnight stop, we banged on the locked front door, managing to rouse a surly night porter who scowled through the glass at us. "What time do you call this to be arriving?" he barked at us. "You're not coming in at this hour." "But you've got to let us in. We're everything but the girl." "I don't care if you're the Dave Clark Bloody Five, you're not coming in." By 1985, We'd made a new album, Love Not Money, much more of a pop-rock record this time, with the band of June, Phil and Neil. As would become the pattern, we failed again to have a hit single to promote the record, but the album still did well, charting at number 10 and selling 100,000 copies. Selling 100,000 records means you get a gold disc. The discs themselves were huge, framed artefacts, a piece of 12-inch vinyl sprayed either gold or silver, according to how many you'd sold. But here's the hilarious bit. It wouldn't necessarily be your own actual record that had been sprayed gold, just any old piece of vinyl. You would know, for instance, that your album had 5 tracks on side one, but there it was, a piece of gold vinyl with 7 clearly separated sets of grooves on that side. You might have earned the prize for selling an admirable number of copies of a fairly quirky, uncommercial British pop record, but there on your wall you might well have a framed and gilded copy of The Number of the Beast by Iron Maiden. Coming of age as I did, as a music fan in the late 1970s, meant that your politics were pretty much inevitably left-wing. At the age of 16, I went from knowing nothing about politics to being a marching, chanting, fully paid-up lefty in the space of about 6 months. Many of the groups I liked, Gang of Four, Skritti Politti, the Mekons, Delta Five, the Au Pairs, were explicitly left-wing, and through their songs and interviews introduced me to concepts and political theories which I was often simply too young and inexperienced to comprehend fully. Nonetheless, I agreed with every word. Even as musical styles changed and many of the old punk battles were left behind, for those of my age, the ideals of the late 1970s remained a driving force. I often feel that I barely recognise the 1980s as a decade, in the form that it's now remembered and repackaged for glib TV programmes. Many of us simply lived an entirely different set of experiences, which seem to have gone unrecorded and unwritten about, so that it's as though they never happened. Scenes which I never witnessed in my life, yuppies chugging champagne in city wine bars, toffs dancing in puffball skirts to Duran Duran, have now become the universal TV shorthand used to locate and define the era. In place of the supposed ambition and greed is good ethos, within the world of the alternative band, we still adhered somewhat piously to the altruism of the benefit gig. In the mid-1980s, we had our own causes, and the benefit gigs were many and various. In 1984, I had sung vocals on a track called Venceremos, with Simon Booth's Working Week, in support of Chilean opposition to the Pinochet regime. In January 1985, we appeared at a benefit gig for Nicaragua, and later that same month, we played with Orange Juice and Aztec Camera at a benefit for the striking miners. We got a name for being part of this lefty wing of pop, along with Paul Weller, Billy Bragg, and so on. And at the time, we were all fired up with the belief that it was perfectly reasonable to try and infiltrate the pop marketplace with leftist politics. Red Wedge was officially launched in November 1985 and was an attempt to fuse all of this somewhat disparate political activity into the one supposedly common cause of ousting the Thatcher government and getting Labour elected. Neil Kinnock was trying to modernise the Labour Party following the landslide defeat of the 1983 election and realised that one strand of this process would be to try to reconnect with the youth vote and to marshal some of that highly motivated activism which was clearly prevalent among young rock fans. There were no cocktail parties, but there were fully minuted meetings at which strategy and theory were discussed and argued. Sometimes, it must be said, by people who might have been more secure in their opinions on guitar amps. It was well-intentioned and earnest, in keeping with the spirit of the times, and was the product both of the idealism, which still permeated political thinking, and the desperation which many of us felt in the face of the apparently unstoppable dominance of the right. Everything culminated in the activity around the 1987 election, during which we played at several gigs aimed at winning specific seats. How prosaic our ambitions seem now, by comparison to today's pop stars and their lofty pronouncements. Far from trying to end global poverty with one wave of a hand, we were simply trying to get a local official elected to a safe seat in Leicestershire. In March of 1986, we started recording our third album, Baby the Stars Shine Bright. The making of it reflected the fact that the way Ben and I made records was beginning to settle into a pattern. The songwriting was shared, and for this record, I wrote lots of lyrics about fame and its destructive qualities, and how it had burned various iconic women. Once my songs were finished, I took a back seat. For the recording, we went into Abbey Road Studios with a whole orchestra and backing singers, and I imagined this was the way Dusty had recorded. Producer Mike Hedges, who would later go on to work with the Manic Street Preachers, was brought in to do a full big production number on it, and it was a million miles from my last band, the Marine Girls, in a shed, in a way that was both thrilling and scary. I'm getting too used to this way of life. Fame is a baby, she rocks me at night. It was a grand gesture of a record, slightly manic in both intent and delivery. It is both a wonderful thing and absolutely barking. The culmination of the whole escapade was a concert at the Royal Albert Hall, where we played with the band and a complete orchestra behind us. It was loud and over the top, and the strings filled the whole enormous space in a suitably climactic kind of way. I was in good voice, and felt like I was singing from somewhere deep inside, and we were making a big noise for once, which was enveloping the room, and the crowd seemed spellbound and entirely mine. I was a backwater girl most nights. That was before I saw my name lights. Starting that squalor were my dreams of mine. I went backstage and hugged everyone, gushing about how it was one of the best nights of my life. Then, a few minutes later, crept back onto the stage to collect something I'd forgotten. Already, the audience had gone and the room was empty. Roadies were dismantling everything, joking and swearing, and out in the hall, bits of litter were being gathered and stuffed into plastic bags. All the lights were on, and in the flat glare, the room seemed suddenly vast and meaningless. Whatever had happened there a few minutes before was over. The atmosphere evaporated, the space simply dead and neutral, waiting for the next night, the next thing to happen, and fill it with some substance. I looked around and wondered, did it mean anything then, when it was so quickly gone?
Tracy Thorne was reading from her memoir, Bedsit Disco Queen. It was abridged by Alison Joseph and produced by Allegra McElroy. And you can catch up with previous episodes by going to the programme's pages of the BBC Radio 4 website. BBC Radio 4's Saturday Drama.
Can I never say Hedda Gabler again?
I'm not Hedda Gabler any longer.
Yes, you're Hedda Tesman now.
Henrik Ibsen's portrait of a passionate woman.
Why didn't you shoot me when you threatened to? Your father's pistol was still on the table.
Cowardice.
Yes, you are a coward.
Terrified of scandal.
From London's Old Vic Theatre production.
I envy you. Maybe if I had that sort of courage, then perhaps I could manage the business of life.
Starring Sheridan Smith in the title role, Hedda Gabler. This week's Saturday Drama at 2:30 on BBC Radio 4.